Okay, so our first speaker of the afternoon session is Michael Nachman from the University of California, Berkeley.
So with jet lag and a big lunch, my goal is to stay awake through the end of my talk. I want to thank Molly for organizing this meeting. It's been really fun, and I'm looking forward to the remaining talks. So we heard this morning about mutation. Today I'm going to talk about what happens after mutation and once we have variation, what the fate of those mutations is. And this is work we've done on environmental adaptation in house mice. Now, we know a lot about the genetic basis of adaptation from well-studied examples like sticklebacks and color variation in mice, but really many of the best examples we have of the genetic basis of adaptive traits come from traits that are either Mendelian or oligogenic. But of course, most traits are probably polygenic and complex, and that's probably true for most adaptive traits as well, and we know much less about this. Examples of these are things like body size and proportions. Bergman's rule, the observation that body size increases as you go into colder environments, or Allen's rule that extremities get smaller in colder environments. Both of these patterns are seen in many mammals. They're probably two of the best described ecogeographic patterns in mammals, and they apply in humans as well. So these are data from indigenous humans from a variety of latitudes showing an increase in body mass with latitude. So these are the kinds of traits that are very common, that are surely adaptive, they're surely polygenic, but we really know much less about the genetic basis of them. And I think that's simply because the genetic basis of complex traits is, of course, complex. And a number of people have pointed this out in various ways, and even arguing that the total number of genes that contribute to these traits must be so large that it's impossible to enumerate them all. And even if we could enumerate some of them, we wouldn't learn much in terms of general properties. And I'm sure everybody read this paper from Jonathan Pritchard's group that had this sentence from 2 years ago. There is an extremely large number of causal variants with tiny effect sizes on height. Most 100 kb windows in the genome include variants that affect height. Well, I loved this paper, but I found that to be one of the most depressing sentences I had ever read. I was ready to abandon my research program at that point. But I think, of course, there's overwhelming evidence for the observation that from GWAS we, in fact, find many loci of very small effect. But most of the traits studied in human GWAS are traits that are under stabilizing or purifying selection. And, oops, this is not the, something lost in the Mac to PC transition. But the situation is different in some situations. And in particular, Fisher and later Alan Orr pointed out that in the early stages of an adaptive walk, when a population is far from its optimum, we expect some mutations of large effect to be favored. And so I think in situations, we see this also under artificial selection, where selection is very strong, then mutations of large effect may be favored compared to situations where stabilizing selection is operating for populations close to the optimum. So I've been interested in using mice as a model to sort of explore this idea. House mice of the subspecies Mus musculus domesticus are native to Western Europe. They're actually native originally to the Middle East and moved into Western Europe with the spread of agriculture about 5,000 years ago. And then in the last few hundred years have been spread around the world. And so when mice that historically were adapted to a Mediterranean climate land in places like Canada or upstate New York, surely those populations are very far from their optimum and experience strong selection. And so we were interested in the possibility that we might be able to find some genes of fairly large effect that explain more polygenic traits. So that's what I want to talk about. First, I'm going to talk about the genetics, and that's published work, but then I want to touch briefly on the role of phenotypic plasticity. And of course, we know for quantitative traits that the environment is also important, and we've been doing some experiments to try to measure how much plasticity there is in things like body size or the length of extremities. So we've conducted a transect of house mice across North and South America. We have 10 mice sampled per population. We have two transects of elevation in the Andes from sea level to over 3,000 meters. And so all of these blue dots are places where we've sampled mice in the field and measured phenotypes on wild-caught individuals and sequenced exomes and whole genomes. And then the red dots are places where we've sampled live animals, brought them back to the lab, and established new wild-derived inbred lines of mice. So we have roughly 10 strains of mice from each of these five populations. And this makes it possible to measure phenotypes in a common laboratory environment and assess whether they have a genetic basis. And as I said, mice that land in upstate New York are experiencing very, very different selection pressures than mice that land in a place like Brazil. Brazil is probably warmer than the ancestral range and less seasonal, and certainly the very northern reaches are colder than the ancestral range. So we think there's probably been selection in both directions. It's not just been selection for adaptation to cold. This work was also motivated by some work done by Carol Lynch in the late 1980s and early 90s. She collected mice along the eastern coast of North America and documented clinal variation in body size and in nest building behavior. And she showed that these differences persist in the lab. I was completely convinced by her data on body size. I was a little skeptical of the idea that nest building behavior would show genetic differences over such a short time scale along this transect. But as I'll show you, she was correct on both counts. But her work really motivated a lot of what we did. So here's just some differences to give you a feel for the phenotypes. These are mice from the equator, from central Florida, and from upstate New York. In the wild and in the lab, we see clines in body size. These mice are 50% bigger than these mice. So these are substantial differences in body size that have evolved in just a few hundred generations. You bring mice into the lab and you give them unlimited food, and they're a little bigger than wild-caught individuals. But those differences persist in the lab. Similarly, we see clines for the length of extremities, including ears and tails. So mice from the equator have big Mickey Mouse ears, and mice from 45 degrees north latitude have much smaller ears, and the same differences are seen in tail length, and these also persist in the lab. So mostly what I'm going to talk about is this transect. I'm not going to talk about all of the transects we've done. I'm going to focus on this one in eastern North America. This is work that was done by a former postdoc in my lab, Megan Pfeiffer-Rixey, who's now at Monmouth University. So again, we have 10 mice per population, 50 mice, both exome and low coverage whole genome sequences, and then live mice from the two ends of the transect. So first, among the wild-caught animals, we see clines for body size. This pattern is seen both in the northern hemisphere and in the southern hemisphere. Those differences persist in the lab, and so here I'm just showing you body mass, but we see the same kind of pattern for body mass and length and BMI. So this is over the first three generations in the wild caught and the next two generations in the lab for females and males. And in all cases, we see that the New York animals are larger, heavier, and fatter than the wild caught animals, and those differences persist. We've now gone up to generation 25 of SIB-SIB mating, and we see these population differences continuing to persist. We've measured, I'm just gonna go through a couple of phenotypes to give you a feel for some of the population differences. We've looked at blood chemistry in a variety of ways. Adiponectin levels are higher and leptin levels are lower in northern latitudes compared to lower latitudes. These are patterns that are also recapitulated in human populations, so there's some interesting parallels between humans and mice in traits like this. New York mice have lower glucose levels than Florida mice. We see this in males and in females. And New York mice build larger nests than Florida mice. And so this is what this looks like. We have a simple assay where we just measure how much cotton they pull down from the hopper in 24 hours. And if you do this for a mouse from New York, they make these giant nests. From Florida, they make smaller nests. If you do it from a mouse from Brazil, they just sit on the cotton. They don't make much of a nest. Activity levels are different. So there's higher activity levels in mice from colder places compared to warmer places. And I should say those differences in nest building are seen even when you account for differences in activity level. So those are the kinds of phenotypic differences that we see in the lab and that persist for many generations and that we would like to try to get at the genetic basis of. So I've said most of this, how we've done exome capture and low coverage whole genome. One of the issues, so the first thing we did was scans for selection, just to ask in an agnostic way what genes appear to show signals of selection. And of course, when you do that, you worry about the correlated history of populations. And so we've used this latent factor mixed model that accounts for the correlated history of populations to find allele frequencies that co-vary with some aspect of the environment after you take population structure into account. Now, in this case, it turns out that there's no isolation by distance. So mice do group by population, but along the eastern coast of North America, nearby populations are not more closely related to one another. So we also just did the simple thing of looking for genes that showed clinal patterns of variation. So we just looked for correlations with latitude and looked at genes that are in the tails of the distribution. And if you do that, you uncover many of the same loci that you get when you use this latent factor mixed model. So what kind of genes show up when we just ask about selection? Well, here's an example. This is the melanocortin 3 receptor. We see strong correlations with latitude at a number of SNPs at this gene. If you look at nearby genes, this signal sort of decays quickly. We think this is probably consistent with selection acting on standing variation. We don't see long haplotypes. We see this pattern independently in a number of transects. There are no non-synonymous SNPs in this gene, so this suggests that it's probably associated with regulatory changes. And known phenotypes in lab mice include many of the phenotypic differences that we see between the ends of the populations. So this seems like a reasonable candidate, but it's just that. It's just a candidate, nothing more. In general, if we ask about all of the outlier SNPs, those that show strong signatures of selection, the vast majority are regulatory, very few are non-synonymous. So at least in this respect, this is very consistent with this sort of omnigenic view of adaptation or a quantitative trait being controlled by regulatory changes. But of course, what we'd like to do is actually link those signatures of selection to specific phenotypes. So to do this, we used gene expression as an intermediate phenotype. So we've done RNA-seq on all of the same mice and looked for clinal patterns of expression variation and then mapped cis-EQTL through associations with SNPs and verified those cis-EQTL using allele-specific expression in heterozygotes. And this is work that was done by Katya Mack, a former graduate student in my lab who's now a postdoc at Stanford with Hunter Fraser. And she's a certifiable, nerdy graduate student. So for her honeymoon, she made it a point when she was on vacation in Scotland to visit Dolly the sheep. So I thought this is a good indication of how serious she was about genetics. So we've used the combination of approaches that I just mentioned to look at the intersection and identify genes that may underlie some of the traits that we're interested in. So the genome scan for selection, clines in gene expression, and cis-EQTL. And when you look at the intersection of those three approaches, there are only 17 genes that show up. And they're shown here on the outside circle of these Manhattan plots. And because we're working with mice, we've got a great database of hypomorphic mutations and knockouts. So we can then ask which of these 17 genes in the lab show phenotypes that resemble the ones that distinguish the ends of the cline. And so we've just added mutant phenotypes here to this circle. And that narrows us down from 17 to just 6 genes for which there are known lab mutants that recapitulate some of the differences we see between the ends of the cline. And so I'm just going to focus on the top two, ADAM17 and BCAT2, and show you what the data look like for each of those as a way of trying to narrow down genes that might actually underlie quantitative traits. So this is for ADAM17. It's a transmembrane protein that's involved in the release of cytokines and growth factors in the receptors. Expression of this gene is correlated with latitude. There's a CISCQTL, so there's a SNP adjacent to this gene that's associated with its expression. That SNP shows clinal patterns of variation along the east coast of North America and shows up as an outlier in this genome scan for selection. Some of this is not coming out in the transition from Mac to PC, but it's an outlier here. And then finally, body mass is correlated with expression at this gene. And these are body mass residuals, so this is body mass corrected for latitude, because body mass varies clinally. We want to just look at the residuals of that. And then finally, SNPs at the same SNPs that show this clinal pattern of variation and affect expression are associated with body mass. A similar pattern is seen for BCAT2. Expression is correlated with latitude. There's a CISCQTL. Body mass and expression are correlated, and this SNP is associated with body mass. So interestingly, before I get to that, I should say one thing that we worried about in this approach is that this is a very structured sample. So we have 5 populations, 10 mice per population, and we're looking for correlations across all 50 individuals. And of course, what you'd really rather do is have a large sample from individual populations. So we did go back and look within individual populations. We only have 10 mice, but in all cases, the trend is in the direction that you see in the total sample. That is, that body mass and expression are correlated. In some cases, it's individually significant. In most, it's not. But again, it's only 10 individuals. So those two genes together account for close to 10% of the phenotypic variance of body mass in our sample. And I just want to contrast that with BMI in humans, where 97 loci account for only 2.7% of the variation in body mass. And so I think this is an example where quantitative variation is still controlled in mice, at least by some loci of larger effect. This is certainly consistent with some of the models that have been proposed, and may also be driven in part by the degree of pleiotropy or lack thereof at particular genes. But I do think that some of this may be due to the fact that selection is very strong in these populations, were presumably initially far from their optimum. How am I doing on time? Okay. So I'm going to talk briefly about phenotypic plasticity for these same traits. And this is something I've become interested in part because there have been a couple of papers in the last few years that have come to very different conclusions about the role of phenotypic plasticity in adaptation. So one was this paper from Cameron Gallimbour in Nature 4 years ago with David Resnick and Kim Hughes in guppies, where they showed that this is plasticity for gene expression in the brain of guppies that are exposed to a situation where predators are not present. And it turns out that the plasticity in gene expression in that case goes opposite in direction to populations that have evolved to be without predators. And so they were arguing that plasticity in gene expression is not adaptive and does not correspond, is actually I'm so tired, jet lag, negatively associated with the evolved difference, which they suggest is the adaptive difference. So that's a case where plasticity is non-adaptive. An opposite situation is shown here. This is work from Ammon Coral and Rasmus Nielsen on lizards that live on lava flows, where it turns out if you put a lizard, these lizards on black lava, they can change colors and they evolve to become they just have a plastic response that makes them darker, but there's also a genetic component that makes them further darker. So in that case, it turns out that the plasticity goes in the same direction as the adaptive response. And the idea there is that, well, if plasticity goes in the same direction, that may facilitate colonization of the novel environment, and genetic changes may come later. But I see this as sort of an interesting unresolved issue about the role of plasticity in adaptation. And so we've become interested in that and have compared mice from cold places with mice from warm places in a full SIB design in which we've reared them at 4 degrees Celsius and 20 degrees Celsius. We've got, I'll show you organismal phenotypes. We haven't yet done the gene expression. And so males are on the right and females are on the left. Blue is the cold population. So these are from New York. Red is the population from Brazil. And the dark lines are the ones reared at room temperature, and the very light lines are those that are reared in the cold. And so this is for body weight, and we see that New York mice, as I mentioned before, are heavier than Brazil mice, but we see no plasticity for body weight when you raise them in the cold. So in that case, there simply doesn't seem to be much plasticity. In contrast, if you measure their tail length, it turns out that there's a lot of plasticity for tail length. So New York mice have shorter tails than Brazil mice. The red line is above the blue lines. But if you take these New York mice and you raise them in the cold, they get even shorter tails. And if you take New York mice and you raise them in the cold, they also get shorter tails. So tail length is clearly a plastic trait, and it goes in the same direction as the adaptive response. Another phenotype that we've studied from this perspective is water consumption. Mice from Tucson, which is a very dry environment, drink less water than mice from any of the other populations. And so we thought, well, let's do the simple experiment of rearing mice with unlimited water and on a water-restricted regime. And measuring weight loss when we restrict water. So this is the prediction. We might expect that mice without water lose weight, so a plastic response, but that mice from the dry environment might lose less weight than mice from a wetter environment. And that's exactly what we see. So these are means. Each line is a different mouse, and we see a slight difference, but significant difference in the amount of water lost. And so then we looked at gene expression in the kidneys for these mice that were raised on unlimited water and water restricted regimes. And the first thing to see in these, so this is gene expression in the kidney, mice by and large group by population. So the yellow are the desert mice, the green are the mice from a wetter environment, and then the different treatments, hydrated and unhydrated, are below that. And so the first grouping is actually by population, not by treatment. And then if we just ask the question, in general, does the evolved response in gene expression go in the same direction or the opposite direction as the plastic response? By and large, it goes in the same direction. So the plastic response here mimics the differences that we see between populations when reared in an environment with unlimited water. So this is just one example of that, so one gene that shows that pattern. The mice from the desert show higher expression of this gene than mice from a wet environment, but in both populations we see a plastic response, and the plastic response goes in the same direction as the evolved response. And in particular, these mice from Edmonton that are raised with very little water have a sort of a level of expression that's equivalent to the baseline level of expression of Tucson mice. So we're interested in this idea that plasticity may, in some cases, facilitate the colonization of a new environment. So what have I told you? Well, house mice show clinal patterns of variation for many traits, and these consistent patterns in different transects suggest that the traits are adaptive. These differences persist in the lab and therefore have a genetic basis. We think that most adaptive evolution in these populations is due to changes in gene regulation. But that some mutations of large effect may be favored when selection is strong. And we have a few candidate genes that we think might be amenable to functional tests. And finally, that phenotypic plasticity might facilitate the colonization of new environments. So I've mentioned the people who did most of this work, Megan Pfeiffer-Rixey and Katya Mack, and Noelle Bittner and Mallory Ballinger, two other graduate students, also contributed. So I'll stop there. Thank you.